You are an old man who thinks in terms of nations and peoples. There are no nations. There are no peoples. There is only one holistic system of systems. One vast and immane, interwoven, interacting, multivariate, multinational dominion of dollars. And you have meddled with the primal forces of nature. And you will atone.
Everybody knows that the dice are loaded. Everybody rolls with their fingers crossed. Everybody knows the war is over. Everybody knows the good guys lost. Everybody knows the fight was fixed. The poor stay poor. The rich get rich, that's how it goes. Everybody knows.
This is the Richard Serrett Show on News Talk 1010 CFRB.
Everybody knows that.
All right, you take a look at the calendar. You know what day it is. It's the 7th anniversary of 9/11, so we will dedicate the bulk of the program to discussing 9/11, specifically the science and politics of 9/11. And a little bit later, much later in the program, time permitting, we'll check in with the dinosaur hunter Bill Gibbons, our explorer and cryptozoologist, regular contributor to the program. But first up, of course, it was 7 years ago this very day that four planes, so the official narrative goes, were used as bombs by Muslim extremists in an attack against the World Trade Center complex, the Pentagon, and one other jet, perhaps destined for the White House, basically was driven into the ground in a field in Pennsylvania. Now, I don't have to tell you that there is an entire community out there dedicating to tugging on a lot of the loose strings, the loose threads, really, attempting to unravel this this official narrative. And one such who has been with us several times in the past is a professor emeritus at the University of Minnesota, professor of philosophy, and also the founder of the organization Scholars for 9/11 Truth. And we're welcome to, or happy rather, to welcome once again to the program James H. Fetzer. Welcome once again, James, to News Talk 1010.
Thanks, Richard. Do please call me Jim.
All right, Jim. Here we are 7 years on. Any new information that has, say, come down the pipe in the last 6 months, a year, that maybe those have been following this?
Well, I think there's quite a bit, including that David Ray Griffin continues to publish new books. He has one called 9/11 Contradictions, demonstrating how the government's various accounts are inconsistent with one another. He has a brand new paper that anyone can access by going to Op-Ed News or just doing a Google search on the title, Was America Attacked by Muslims on 9/11? And he lays out the evidence that contradicts that opinion. I would suggest that a study by Elias Davidson, an Icelandic scholar, is quite an important recent contribution, where he demonstrates that the government has no evidence that these hijackers were even aboard these planes, that it doesn't have any ticket receipts, it doesn't have any videos, it doesn't have any eyewitness reports. Even when you come to the alleged bodies, Richard, they were identified by a process of elimination. In other words, they identified the passengers and then had five bodies left over or four bodies left over and said those must be the hijackers. There was no positive ID, which, of course, is a ludicrous way to proceed. And in addition, a couple of astute observations have been made by George Nelson, an Air Force colonel who is an expert on air crashes and on airplane parts, who has observed that each of these planes had thousands of uniquely identifiable component parts, and that none of them, not one, has been produced by the government from any of the four crash sites. And John Lear, who's the son of the designer of the Learjet and one of our nation's most distinguished pilots, has pointed out that any time a captain has his commercial carrier pull away from a terminal, he must submit an envelope before he's authorized for departure, where the envelope includes a passenger manifest and a checklist that the plane is ready for flight and airworthy, and none of the envelopes from any of those four aircraft were ever produced.
Jim Fetzer is with us, American philosopher, distinguished McKnight University professor emeritus at the University of Minnesota Duluth, known for his advocacy of the 9/11. I hate to use the word conspiracy because Jim, I don't know how you feel. I think that the official version is the conspiracy. I mean, they're the ones that are basically saying that Osama bin Laden conspired to fly these planes into buildings. I think that.
Well, Richard, you're absolutely right. I mean, a conspiracy only requires two or more individuals who are collaborating together in pulling off some illegal act. So when we have a couple of guys knocking off a 7-Eleven, they're actually engaged in a conspiracy, even if they're charged under an armed robbery statute. Most American conspiracies tend to be economic. Think of Enron or WorldCom, or different kinds of frauds, like the Keating 5 scandal, for example, to pick one at random. These things happen all the time in American finance, and they can be as trivial as insider trading. You may remember Martha Stewart went to jail. Well, that's collusion between a stockbroker and his customer. Where often it happens between different brokers. They'll give inside information to one another in the expectation the next time around they'll be the beneficiary. So there are lots of ways in which these things can go down.
Well,
but your point is impeccable. See, since there were 19 Islamic fundamentalists purportedly bringing about these atrocities under the control of a guy off in a cave in Afghanistan, and so long as 19 is a number equal to or greater than 2, we had a conspiracy. And the fact of the matter is that when Bush warned us against outrageous conspiracy theories, I'm quite sure he wasn't thinking of the government's own official account, but given that it's so easy to demonstrate that it is untenable in every significant respect, I think it turns out to be the most outrageous of all the conspiracy theories, but it's impossible to discuss 9/11 without discussing conspiracies, because if the government's account is right, it was a conspiracy, and obviously if the government's account was wrong, it was a conspiracy, just another deeper and more sinister one.
But is the onus not on those that are asserting the official narrative, I mean, to make their case? I mean, if, for example, they were to apprehend Osama bin Laden, and there were to be a trial. I mean, they would have to make their case. They would have to present their evidence. And if the defense lawyer was to present obviously reasonable doubt, that case would fall apart. And obviously there is plenty of reasonable doubt. But my main point is whenever you confront someone in a friendly or a diplomatic way about some of the loose ends here with the official narrative, they say, well, prove it. And my point is, well, no, the burden of proof is with you. You must make your case.
You're absolutely right, except they produced this voluminous work called the 9/11 Commission Report, which was coordinated by an insider, a guy named Philip Zelikow, who had not only overseen the transition of the national security apparatus from Clinton to Bush, he'd co-authored a book with Condoleezza Rice. And if you can believe this, Richard, and I guarantee most of your listeners will not know this interesting aspect of Philip Zelikow's background, he's not an historian, he's not a scientist, rather he's an expert in the creation and manipulation of public myths. So he was the perfect guy to put together a myth by having these story that would, infatuate us with the heroism and, trouble us with the horror. And yet it was one that could be substantiated by fabricated evidence, which appears to be what was done across the board.
Well, what do you mean by that? That was what he did for a living, create myths? How, in what capacity?
Oh, if you just go to Wikipedia and you'll find that the summary of his qualifications and background as an academician was his area of specialization was a creation and manipulation of public, or you can read that, political myths. So this guy's an expert in, as it were, mythology, but a special kind of mythology, a kind of mythology that affects the public.
All right. Jim Fetzer, my guest, the founder of Scholars for 9/11 Truth, will open up the phone lines. And we're probably going to take this for most of the evening as we mark the 7th anniversary of the 9/11 attacks. 416-872-1010, Star Talk, Star 8255, toll free from out of town, 1-800-561-CFRB. We welcome all comers, whether you believe in the official version of the events that transpired on that day, or if you would count yourself among, I guess, the 9/11 truth movement, or officially or unofficially, believe that there's something else going on here that we haven't been told about, or you may simply have questions about either the official version or for lack of a better word, the conspiracy version of the 9/11 events. Back with more of the Richard Serrett Show. Stay with us on News Talk 1010 CFRB.
The owners of the system are asleep. Now we can play.
The truth will set you free. But first, it'll really tick you off. The Richard Serrett Show on News Talk 1010 CFRB.
Jim Fetzer, my guest, founder of Scholars for 9/11 Truth. It is the 7th anniversary of the 9/11 attacks. Now, Jim, you mentioned David Rick Griffin. I had him on the program, several weeks back, maybe a month or two, talking about his new book, and he picks apart the 9/11 Commission report and highlights the omissions and the errors and the outright lies and distortions.
Yeah.
To me, one of the most compelling things that has come out of this is... And I don't know how much of this the public is aware of or has paid attention to, and that is we have the transport secretary, the testimony of the transport secretary, Norman Mineta, that wasn't actually even allowed.
Yes.
When he was in the Presidential Emergency Operations Center beneath the east wing of the White House.
That's right.
That day in the morning, and what he saw and what he heard. Can you outline a little bit of what...
Absolutely. Believe it or not, Richard, I managed to get this story on Fox, on Hannity and Combs, not once, but actually twice. Norman Mineta reported that he was there where the vice president appeared to be in charge. And, of course, incredibly, there was a massive anti-terrorist drill going on that disrupted the normal communications between the FAA and NORAD, so that none of the planes that you would have expected would have responded to the hijacked aircrafts were in fact available, and none of them ever did respond until after the alleged crashes had taken place. And Mineta said that a young aide came up to the vice president, said, sir, it's 50 miles away. Came back and said, sir, it's 30 miles away. Came back and said, sir, it's 10 miles away. Does the order still stand? Cheney turned on the aide and snapped at him and said, of course, have you heard anything to the contrary? Now, what this appears to have meant, which Norman Mineta himself wasn't clear about, is this was an order to stand down, to not shoot down the plane. Now, shooting down the plane would have been an obvious thing to do, because then you lose the passengers in the plane, but you don't also lose the property and the personnel at the target. If the order had been to shoot down the plane, then no doubt the plane would have been shot down, since the Pentagon may be the most heavily defended building in the world. So this is really a stunning indication that the vice president himself was personally complicit. And it was fascinating because when I came on the Hannity and Combs for the first time, which was at the end of June of 2006, Alan Combs asked me, did I have any evidence whatsoever that implicated any member of the administration, including Vice President Cheney? And of course I was so delighted that he asked that question that I proceeded to tell the story. And then when they had me back on about 2.5 months later, I was able to tell the same story again.
Now, have you ever talked to former Transport Secretary Norman Mineta?
No, I haven't personally, but it's fascinating that the morning after that program was broadcast on Fox, the White House announced that Norman Mineta was retiring from government.
Now, the timing of this is crucial because... I believe the timing was that Flight 77 hit the Pentagon at about 9:37, 9:40.
Yes.
Cheney's testimony was that he had arrived, obviously after that, and was told that the Pentagon had been hit. But,
yeah. But this is all self-serving, false information, which actually implicates him because it's evidence of consciousness of guilt. He was contradicted by unusual authorities like Richard Clark, our anti-terrorist expert, by Condoleezza Rice and others who explained how Cheney had arrived much earlier than that and, in fact, was in the underground bunker before anything happened there. Interestingly, by the way, we have lots of evidence that whatever hit the Pentagon, it wasn't a Boeing 757.
We'll get into that, definitely, Jim. Just one final question, and that is, now, Norman Mineta, he was the Secretary of Transport, correct? Transport Secretary.
Secretary of Transportation, yes.
Okay. Now, was he attempting to have his testimony heard before the 9/11 Commission? Was he not allowed to testify?
No. He presented his testimony. It was recorded. You can find it on YouTube. But they didn't include it in their report. See, they were very clever. They simply excised it. It's like Building 7, which, of course, was hit by no jet planes, had no jet fuel-based fires, came down at 5:20 in the afternoon in a complete, abrupt, sudden, dramatic collapse at the speed of free fall in about 6.5 seconds, right into its own footprint. It was a classic, a vintage controlled demolition. And I think they were so baffled as to what to say about it, they simply didn't mention that Building 7 also was destroyed on 9/11.
We'll get into the...
In fact, it's taken until now, Richard, for the NIST to come out and claim, make the ludicrous claim, in fact, that's the only building that's ever been destroyed by fire in the history of structural engineering.
All right, we'll definitely get into the World Trade Center complex and what happened to it on 9/11, 2001. When we continue, news awaits at the bottom of the hour. Back on the other side with the founder of the Scholars for 9/11 Truth, Jim Fetzer, right here on the Richard Serrett Show. Stay with us. News Talk 1010 CFRB.
Believe those who are seeking the truth. Doubt those who find it. The Richard Serrett Show on News Talk 1010 CFRB. To talk to Richard, call 416-872-1010. Toll free 1-800-561-CFRB or star talk on your cellular.
Jim Fetzer is here, a professor of philosophy, religion, a theologian, and the website is 911scholars.org, and there you will find on the front page a DVD produced by... are you the producer, Jim, of the Science and Politics of 9/11?
Yeah, on behalf of the society.
Okay, the science...
And, of course, David is the theologian, and my area is the philosophy of science. But, you know, the question you raise, Richard, about the burden of proof is such a good one. It may be worth making two brief comments about it.
Sure, I just wanted to finish plugging your website.
Yeah, well, I love it. Yeah, 911scholars.org. I hope we'll have a lot of viewers go there and check out, for example, Why Doubt 9/11 in the upper left-hand corner, where you have about 20 different demonstrations of how we've been able to refute the official government account. And in the upper right-hand corner, PatriotsQuestion911.com, click on that, and you'll find over 1,100 experts in many different areas. You got pilots and aviation professionals, you got military experts, intelligence professionals, you got a whole bunch of academicians, you got hundreds and hundreds of architects and engineers, you've got members of the survivors, and in every case you have for them, you have a photograph, their picture, a bio sketch, and a statement they made about why they are disbelieving of
All right.
the government's account.
Now, you wanted to make a couple of points about the burden of proof.
Exactly. That's such a good question. The first is that they combine the word conspiracy with the word theory, which can be used in a strong or a weak sense. In a weak sense, a theory is just a speculation, a rumor, a guess, a conjecture. But in the strong sense, a theory is an empirically testable explanatory hypothesis. Think of Newton's theory of gravitation, Einstein's theory of relativity. So what we have done is approach this matter, what happened on 9/11, scientifically by seeking to sort out the various hypotheses, developing their consequences, and then testing them against the available evidence to see which confers the highest probability on the evidence, which in turn thereby acquires the highest degree of evidential support. And it turns out that many of the government claims not only have a zero probability, but they aren't even physically possible because their occurrence would violate laws of physics, of engineering, of aerodynamics. The second point I'd make is that we've gone through several different stages in the argumentative process, where the government laid out its case in the 9/11 conspiracy publication. Then a number of critics, including, for example, the French scholar Thierry Meyssen, published 9/11, the Big Lie, and Pentagate, demonstrating that what that was being said about the Pentagon was complete rubbish. David Ray Griffin published his early book, The New Pearl Harbor. And then you had rebuttals coming from various groups attempting to show that these criticisms of the government were wrong, the most important being from Popular Mechanics, a book entitled Debunking 9/11 Myths. Now, David Griffin has responded to that by a debunking 9/11 debunking. So what we're doing is going through these various stages where arguments are being made and they're being taken apart, but I've got to tell you that the overwhelming evidence is so much on the side of the critics of the government that I would go so far as to say in no significant respect is what the government has told us capable of being shown to be true.
Yeah, we're going through, I guess if this was a criminal trial, this would be discovery.
Well, in a way, it would be discovery. You know, here it's very interesting how you might establish a chain of link of responsibility. As a philosopher of science, I'm very familiar with the principles known as inference to the best explanation, where you consider various alternatives. You know, what provides the best explanation for all the data? Is it the official account that 19 Islamic fundamentalists hijacked these four aircraft and perpetrated these deeds? Or is it something else, including, for example, that the government was simply taken by surprise or that the government was complicit in this? And I must tell you, that was one of the great virtues of David's first book about the new Pearl Harbor, is he systematically went through various alternative explanatory hypotheses and showed only the strongest that really implicate the government in arranging for 9/11 were substantiated by the evidence.
All right, let's work in some calls, and then we'll get to the World Trade Center complex. And let's begin with Leon on Highway 401. Leon, welcome to News Talk 1010.
Hi, guys. Thanks. Yeah, I don't know if you caught on Monday night they had a show on the Passion High on the third building that fell.
On Building 7, and what was the line of it?
Yeah, they interviewed the owner of the World Trade Center. I think his name was Silverman.
Larry Silverstein. Yeah,
Silverstein. And he said, the building had been insured about 6 months earlier with terrorist insurance, and that they had him on video actually saying, we were discussing what was going on, and we thought the best thing to do would be to pull it.
Right.
And that, as he says it, he's pulling down with his arms.
I know. Well, it's very damaging. I know. That's a remarkable statement he made to National Public Radio, which they recorded, and you can find on YouTube again, for example. So here, Larry Silverstein, when he took over the World Trade Center, and this was only about 6 weeks before the event, he replaced the security company that had been responsible since its original development with another outfit called Securicom, where it just so happens that a member of the board of directors of Securicom was none other than Marvin Bush, the brother of W. And more interestingly even, the chief executive officer of Securicom was a fellow named Wirt Walker III. You may forget that W stands for Walker. This was a Bush cousin. And it looks as though there were a lot of funny business going on in relation to the security with this company that Larry Silverstein put in place. He also insured the World Trade Center against terrorist attacks for the tune of $3.5 billion. And then when, of course, there were two planes, he claimed double indemnity and went for seven. He settled for like $4.4 billion on the Twin Towers.
All right.
There's lots of stuff about Building 7 that's utterly fascinating, including, for example, that the BBC reported at 4:57 p.m. that the building had collapsed, which wouldn't take place for another 23 minutes. So you have Jane Stanley, this reporter for the BBC, explaining how the Solomon Brothers building has collapsed. That was another name for Building 7 because Solomon Brothers bought up 20 or 30 floors and then rebuilt the inside of the building more to their specification. This was such a robust building. In fact, it was erected over two enormous electrical generators providing electricity to lower Manhattan, and I'm convinced it may have been the most robust building ever constructed in the history of structural engineering. But right over her shoulder, you can see Building 7 still standing in the background. So this has to be one of the most embarrassing and illustrative incidents of collusion between the mass media, the intelligence agencies, and the government that we have ever seen.
BBC later reported that they somehow lost that tape, although it was captured forever on YouTube.
Oh, so. Yeah, absolutely, Richard.
All right.
You can find that, too, all over the place.
Leon, thanks for the call. We'll take a quick time out. Come back with Jim Fetzer, founder of Scholars for 9/11 Truth. Back with more of The Richard Serrett Show, News Talk 1010 CFRB. Professor Jim Fetzer, joins us, and he, the founder of Scholars for 9/11 Truth. Let's work in a couple more calls here before we get to the World Trade Center complex. And Mark in Toronto, welcome to News Talk 1010.
Yeah, I'd like to make 3 points quickly. First, I challenge you. You're assuming that anybody in government, you know, before 9/11, we've never had anything happen like this. We're not talking about Pearl Harbor, but on the mainland in modern-day history. And so it's just possible Cheney just made a bad decision when he didn't want that plane shot down. Number two, that film that was shown on Monday night on TV, the other gentleman mentioned, I did watch it as well. I was quite shocked because they did show this BBC reporter with the building behind her. So that's a clip, I guess, they saved from early on. And, I mean, it's possible she got wrong information, so I'll give her that credit. But the Building 7, they showed the three sides of the building. The glass was still in place in the building, which proves that there was no explosion in that building. And the one side where glass was knocked out was from the heat and the fire of because that side was facing the other two buildings. And, of course, debris, you know, flew from those two buildings when they collapsed, and some of that debris was pretty hot. And of course, it would go in the carpets and so on and start fires in that building. And by the way, the owner of the building, when he said poet, he actually was referring to pull them. He was in a bit of shock when he was referring to the firemen, pull them out of the building because there's no use. There's nothing more they can do. It had been burning for over 5 hours.
Well, listen, you sound like a sincere fellow, and I don't want to suggest that you're gullible, but what you're saying is all a lot of nonsense. If anyone wants to get the big picture on what happened on 9/11, if you start thinking about motive, means, and opportunity, who could have pulled this off, who benefited? Nothing more, no one benefited more than the Bush administration. They revived their sagging political fortunes. They now had a rationale for these wars in Iraq and Afghanistan, which in fact were in violation of international law, the UN Charter, and even the U.S. Constitution, and for passing the Patriot Act, where the anthrax attack, of course, just happened to be targeted at Tom Daschle and Patrick Leahy, who were the two key Democratic senators who wanted to hold hearings about this. Now, if you want to see the big pictures I've laid it out, go online and look at 9/11 and the neocon agenda, and you'll see why I think that the administration almost certainly was involved here, though I also believe that they may have outsourced some of the attack to the Israelis, and that the Mossad may have been involved. And if you want evidence of that, I'd be glad to address that too. But what you're failing to appreciate is that this building was extremely robust. It was built with solid steel support beams, which means they weren't even hollowed out in the center, unlike the World Trade Center. The melting point of steel is 2,800 degrees. The fires, office fires, only burn about 500 degrees. So you got a huge leap, not just in logic, but in the physics of the situation, to suggest that 500 degree fires could possibly cause that building to collapse. All the floors came down at exactly the same time. You can see the slight indentation where they took out one key support column early, so you get this slight indent at the top. Go online and look at This Is an Orange. This Is an Orange. And you'll see a very nice capsule summary about the case. When it was all done, there was a stack of 5 to 7 floors worth of pancakes. These were the floors accumulated. Now, it's crucial to appreciate that the way that Building 7 was destroyed was completely different than the way the Twin Towers were destroyed. In the case of Building 7, all the floors moved at the same time. There was a pile of pancakes, came down free fall speed. In the case of the Twin Towers, they also were destroyed in about the same time as free fall, about 10 seconds apiece, but all the floors remain stationary. They're all waiting their turn to be blown to kingdom come, in Morgan Reynolds' memorable phrase. The buildings are not just pulverized, but they're turned into very fine dust. And when it's all done, there's not only no pancakes, but I had Father Frank Morales on a radio show that I host, and who was one of the very first responders on the scene, who telling me that it was actually below ground level those buildings were destroyed. So you got two completely different mechanisms at work here. It's not possible that that building was brought down by fires. There were some diesel tanks there, but diesel, it turns out, burns at a low temperature and is non-explosive. So I would suggest you really need to do more homework. You sound to me like you're someone who maybe has been taken in by the Popular Mechanics book or by the NIST's report. Frankly, I spent 35 years teaching logic, critical thinking, and scientific reasoning. And when you put together the evidence with the hypotheses, there's no way in which the claim that the building was brought down by fire achieves any degree of plausibility whatsoever.
All right, Mark, thank you for the call. Jim, stay put. We'll take a time out, come back, get to some more calls. I do want to follow up on a couple of points that Mark made there that I think need exploring. And one of those has to do with the fact that the, according to this documentary he saw, the windows were still intact, which is curious. I mean, if we're talking about some sort of controlled demolition, that would seem to be rather unusual.
Well, if we're talking about fires that are supposed to be hot enough to bring down the building, they would have shattered the windows, too. So.
A good point. Excellent point. All right, back with more of our conversation on 9/11 with Jim Fetzer, founder of Scholars for 9/11 Truth, The Richard Serrett Show, News Talk 1010, CFRB.
The Richard Serrett Show continues on News Talk 1010, CFRB.
Jim Fetzer stays with us, founder of Scholars for 9/11 Truth. I do want to follow up on another point that Mark made, Jim, and that again goes back to the vice president sitting in the Presidential Emergency Operations Center, according to the testimony of Secretary Mineta.
Right.
And Mark's contention was that, well, perhaps it was merely a lapse in judgment that Dick Cheney did not give the order to shoot down Flight 77 before it hit the Pentagon. I think I know what your response is, but go ahead.
Well, it's a matter of relative probabilities. You know, you got alternative hypotheses. Some of them are wildly implausible, like this one. I mean, if we go back to his claims about what Larry Silverstein said, philosophers are experts in the analysis of language from the point of view of syntax or grammar, semantics or meaning, and pragmatics or the context in which they're asserted. Larry Silverstein said to someone he described as the fire commander, and that verbal pause indicates to me knew this person under a different designation, that there had been so much death and devastation, perhaps the best thing to do is to pull it. He then said they made the decision to pull and we watched the building come down. Now, it is a word that is used to refer to inanimate objects, and it's singular. It's got nothing to do with them or firemen. And when he says, you know, and they made the decision to pull and we watched the building come down, how could the semantics, the meaning, be any more obvious than that he's suggesting it be brought down by controlled demolition, and it was then brought down by controlled demolition when they made the decision? Now, it couldn't have been the case that that building could have been brought down with controlled demolition unless it was primed for demolition. It had to be already wired with explosives and so forth, and this was a brilliant example of a classic case of controlled demolition. But to put this away utterly and completely and forever, I would like to believe there were no firemen in the building at that point in time. So there wasn't any them to pull out of the building.
Do we know that for a fact? How do we know that? There were no firemen in Building 7.
Oh, they were all out late in the morning. I mean, there's lots of evidence about this, Richard, you know, if you dig into it. But the fact is that there weren't any firemen in the building, which is, you know, maybe the coup de grace of the whole thesis that he was advancing.
Okay, and very quickly back to his assertion that
happens is somebody like Silverstein lets something slip out, and then they have to try to stick their thumb in the dike, you know, to keep it from. It's so blatant. It's so obvious. You know, it's like Rumsfeld had his, of course, slip of the tongue where he talked about a missile hitting the Pentagon, and then they try to explain it away. Well, the question is relative probabilities. Think in terms of probabilities. Is it possible Larry Silverstein could have meant pull the firemen out of the building if there weren't even any firemen in the building and use the word it to refer to them and so forth and said not just that he suggested they pull it, but they made the decision to pull and we watched the building come down? I mean, how much sense, how probable is it that the interpretation we've been offered could possibly be correct? I suggest to you it's got no plausibility whatsoever.
All right. News awaits at the top of the hour. Back on the other side, Jim Fetzer is the founder of Scholars for 9/11 Truth. You're listening to The Richard Serrett Show, News Talk 1010, CFRB.
We deal in illusions, man. None of it is true. But you people, you're beginning to believe the illusions we're spinning here. You're beginning to think that the tube is reality and that your own lives are unreal. In God's name, you people are the real thing. We are the illusion. So turn off your television sets. Turn them off now. Turn them off right now. Turn them off and leave them off. Turn them off right in the middle of the sentence I'm speaking to you now. Turn them off!
Brainwashed in our childhood. Brainwashed by the school. Brainwashed by our teachers. Brainwashed by all the rules. Brainwashed by our leaders. By our kings and queens. Brainwashed in the open and brainwashed behind the scenes.
This is the Richard Serrett Show on News Talk 1010 CFRB.
All right, Jim Fetzer is with us, philosophy professor emeritus at the University of Minnesota Duluth, founder of Scholars for 9/11 Truth. Their website, once again, 911scholars.org, and there you will find a DVD, The Science and Politics of 9/11, and also the book, The 9/11 Conspiracy, The Scamming of America. Jim, the theory, Stephen Jones, a physics professor, his theory that the World Trade Center towers and Building 7 brought down by prepositioned cutter charges. Walk me through that, because I think for some people, while I certainly subscribe to the idea that planes didn't bring those buildings down, the stumbling block for me is how did they get those cutter charges in there unnoticed? I mean, to wire a building that size would be a huge undertaking.
Yeah, not only that, Richard, but if you had used cutter charges there, then the building would basically have been brought down by the force of gravity, and you should have had a massive pile of debris. And at the Twin Towers, you don't. Now, I'm willing to entertain the hypothesis that thermite or thermate, this cutter charge was used, say, for example, to bring down the top floors to create the impression that you had some kind of pancake collapse that was taking place. But even Steve himself has admitted that with regard to the South Tower, the top 30 floors started to pivot over and fall, and you would think it would have come down in a massive heap on the street below, but what happens is it's pulverized and turns to dust in midair. So he acknowledges that in an article that his early article talking about explained how the World Trade Center was destroyed. So I think you have a partial explanation at best by alluding to these cutter charges. It's certainly one that makes more sense in relation to Building 7 because there you do have a stack of pancakes and a massive pile of debris. The building is not turned into very fine dust as was the case with the Twin Towers. And some of the evidence that Steve and others who support that view have offered turns out to be unable to withstand critical inspection. For example, one is a group of workers peering into a cavern, which is all aglow, and that's supposed to be molten metal, but molten metal would be around 3,000 degrees. Think about putting your face over a tea spout when it starts to percolate. It's only 212 degrees or a little higher. You're not going to do that because it's going to scald your face. If this actually were a cavern looking down into molten metal, the skin would be melting from their faces and arms, and yet they have bare shirts, bare arms. Another claim he's made is that this one kind of waterfall coming out from the 80th floor is supposed to be evidence of thermite or thermate. But there's something peculiar about it. If it actually were the case, you had thermite and thermate distributed all over the building, then you would think of a phenomenon like that would be randomly distributed around the building. In other words, you'd have lots of places where you had these little waterfalls, not just one. It appears that floor was owned by the Fuji Bank building, and they had a huge array of batteries that was used as a backup power source so they could preserve their clients' records, so that I believe what we're actually seeing there is peculiar to that location was actually resulted from the melting of the batteries, which has a relatively low melting point.
Okay, so then in your estimation, what was responsible for bringing down North South Tower and Building 7?
Well, this is Building 7 is a classic controlled demolition. So,
okay.
You know, what's interesting is how could Larry Silverstein know enough about the building to suggest that they pull it and to know that it was prepped to be pulled? I mean, what's the probability he just blurts that out by chance, as it were, instead of actually being knowledgeable? It's like, how could Rumsfeld talk about a missile hitting the building when it appears that, in fact, a missile actually did hit the building? That's a fascinating story because there were 125 casualties at the Pentagon, and about three dozen of them were budget experts, financial analysts, who apparently were in that part of the building trying to track down the missing $2.3 trillion from the Pentagon budget he'd announced the day before they couldn't track. Well, that's amazing they did that on a Monday because it's early in the week and reporters are going to dog you. It's going to turn into a big story and grow legs. It's as though he knew something was going to happen in the interim that was allow him to waltz back into Congress and ask for hundreds of billions more in defense spending, even though he just talked about squandering or losing track of $2.3 trillion. That's with a T now. That's a big buck number. Now, Building 7 appears to be, in my opinion, completely explicable on the basis of a classic controlled demolition. In fact, the outfit that was hired to clean it up, which just happened to be named Controlled Demolition Incorporated, probably was responsible for priming that building. Now, when it comes to the Twin Towers, where they're being turned into dust, this is much more complicated, and it appears to me there's no way in which conventional modes of demolition, with cutter charges or without, dynamite, RDX, whatever, stuff that you can buy on eBay, by the way, could possibly have done the job. You'd have a massive pile of rubble in the end, and here it was all turned to dust. So I suggest, I follow the work of Judy Wood here, which you can find on the website drjudywood.com, a former mechanical engineer at Clemson, who has degrees in applied physics and engineering mechanics and materials engineering science, and who has offered the hypothesis that was some kind of directed energy weapon. Now, it turns out there are whole families of these, and they're now beginning to admit that they have these weapons, that they've been using them in Iraq, and one of the beauties of using these weapons is that they're done from a distance and they're invisible so that you can have a plausible deniability that they were actually used. But it's something like that. We don't know exactly how it was done, but it has to be in this general area.
All right. Let's...
And Richard, what's fascinating about that is that implicates the military-industrial complex because those are the only people who have these high-tech weapons. It's not something you can buy on eBay.
Well, what are we talking about, like an electromagnetic pulse? Are we talking about scalar technology?
Well, there are a variety of possibilities. I mean, I wish I were, if I were enough of a physicist, I'll tell you, when when we gave the conference on the science and politics of 9/11, when it was all done, I invited members of the audience to come up and say a few words, and an elderly lady came up and explained she had a PhD in physics and that she didn't know why she hadn't seen it before, but after watching Judy Wood's presentation, she realized that they had to have used masers. So it's something like lasers, masers, plasmoids, something going on here, very, very sophisticated, that turns these 500,000-ton buildings into millions of cubic yards of very fine dust.
All right, Linda's in Brampton. Welcome to Newstalk 1010 CFRB.
Oh, good evening. Thank you. And thank you, Richard, for taking my call. And this is a great show. I just wanted to bring up a couple of points. A few years ago, I saw, I think it was Dateline NBC, they showed a cover of a music band, an African-American band. I believe they were called Soup. 2 months before the 9/11 attack, it showed the Twin Towers blowing up. Once the attack happened, the CDs were pulled off the shelf. They changed the covers. Also, allegedly, children, African-American children in Brooklyn were bragging before the towers were blown up. They would point to them and say, see those towers? One day they're going to be blown up. They're going to be destroyed. I think what's happened is we have a number of nationalities here who were involved in this terror attack, along with the Bush government. And unfortunately, the Arabs have become the scapegoat.
Oh, I think you're absolutely right. That they even showed some footage, during the midst of all of this calamity of Arabs cheering off in Palestine, and it turns out, as a Palestinian ambassador observed, that this was archival footage. They pulled it out for a holy day or an event where, in fact, the young Palestinian boys had put flowers in the weapons of Israeli soldiers, and they thought maybe things were going to be better. It was fake footage. It was, real footage, but it had nothing to do with 9/11. In fact, all the reports I have are that the Palestinians were just as floored by this. They were just as silent and astonished at what was going on as anyone else. And this, in my opinion, is a very strong indication of what it was really all about. I mean, the whole event has been used to justify these wars, which were actually for the sake of oil, Israel, and ideology. Oil, Saddam had kicked out the big international oil companies when he first came to power, and they resented that, and they've only started to be able to get back in now that he's gone. Israel had problems with Saddam because he was supporting the families of suicide bombers, and also because they wanted to obtain oil for themselves. And then ideology, we have the neoconservatives who wanted to create a major American military presence in this geopolitically sensitive area and project it outward. This hasn't quite worked out the way they would like, but that was certainly their intention. I outline all this, by the way, in that article I mentioned, 9/11 and the neocon agenda. A version of that on America First Books might be especially useful because I have embedded the links to major supporting documents.
All right, Jim, stay with us. I'm back with more in a moment as we discuss the 7th anniversary of 9/11. Back with The Richard Serrett Show, Newstalk 1010 CFRB.
This is not a psychotic episode. This is a cleansing moment of clarity.
James Fetzer stays with us until at least the top of the hour. We're dedicating the bulk of the program to 9/11. This is the 7th anniversary of the 9/11 attacks, and he is the founder of Scholars for 9/11 Truth, out to the 400, and we say hello to Brian. Welcome to Newstalk 1010, Brian.
Hi, Richard. Thanks for taking my call. I had a question about some information I saw and read in Barry Zwicker's book about the World Trade Center building number 7 collapsing. But it was announced before the collapse, and they actually had a BBC clip that has been pulled from the internet that shows the reporter talking about the collapse, but the building is standing behind her.
Yeah, Brian, James actually mentioned that a little bit earlier, perhaps before you joined us. But I believe also, James, Aaron Brown at CNN at the time also made the same gaffe, did he not?
Oh, that's very interesting, Richard. I'd like to check that out. That's very interesting. Another one of these gaffes, by the way, was made by Rudy Giuliani, who said that the reason he didn't go to his command center, which happened to be ironically located in Building 7, was because they'd been told the Twin Towers were going to collapse, And he's never been able to answer the question, who would have told him that? How could anyone know that in advance unless they were in on the scheme? Because no steel structure high-rise had ever collapsed due to fire in the history of structural engineering. And if our analysis is correct, that's true not only before and after 9/11, but of 9/11 too.
Do you believe that Flight 93 originally was intended to hit Building 7, and that's why they had to bring it down anyway?
Well, the speculation about that, exactly what happened with Flight 93, is very bizarre. I'll just give you an illustration. At the trial of Zacharias Moussaoui to impose a punishment, this took place in April of 2006. He had actually been tried in April of 2005, a year before, when he confessed to being involved in a plot to have a plane strike the White House in order to free the blind sheik who'd been involved in the earlier attempt to bomb the Twin Towers in 1993. But in 2006, they were trying him for life, to be executed, or life imprisonment, on the grounds that if he'd only come forward to admit his complicity in these events, perhaps lives might have been saved. That's absurd on several grounds. Number one, he didn't confess to being involved in 9/11, and he wasn't convicted of that, so they're playing a shell game. Number two, we have something here called the Fifth Amendment. You're not responsible for implicating yourself. Number three, and perhaps the most devastating, a member of the FBI who'd been following him explained that he had told his superiors he suspected this guy might be involved in some plot to use airplanes to attack, and even suggested the Twin Towers, later saying that was just a lucky guess. But get this, Richard, he told his superiors about this not once or twice, but 70 times. And I say, well, 4 or 5 times, that might be simple incompetence. When you're getting up to 24, 25 times, that's obviously criminal neglect. When you get up to 70 times, it's obvious they're keeping these guys under wraps in order to roll them out as the patsies when the crime actually is committed.
All right, we've got a break for news here at the bottom of the hour. If you have a line, hold on to it. Back to more of our conversation with James Fetzer on the 7th anniversary of 9/11 here on the Richard Serrett Show, News Talk 1010 CFRB. Just a reminder, tomorrow night I will be presenting Alex Jones' new documentary, the Canadian debut premiere screening of the 9/11 Chronicles, Part 1, Truth Rising, at the Review Cinema, 400 Roncesvalles Avenue. Some tickets still available, both at the door, and I believe if you log on to conspiracyculture.com, you can reserve tickets there. They'll be waiting for you at the door. And, of course, Conspiracy Culture also presenting. That's 9:30 p.m. tomorrow night at the Review Cinema, 400 Roncesvalles Avenue. Hope to see you there. Of course, I'll present and then rush back here and do my program beginning at 10 p.m. James Fetzer is with us, the founder of Scholars for 9/11 Truth. And, Jim, let's move on to Flight 93 for a moment. And this, of course, we're all familiar with the heroes and Let It Roll and the multitude of cell phone calls coming from people like Todd Beamer, etc.
Yeah, all of which appears to be a fabrication. Keith Dewdney, who's a professor of computer science at Western Ontario, flew around the country with different kinds of cell phones and found that when you get above a relatively low speed, you know, a few hundred miles an hour, or relatively low altitude, you know, a couple thousand feet, they don't work. Plus, let me tell you this, I think your audience will be astonished to know that when they played the alleged cockpit voice recording in the trial of Zacharias Moussaoui, it included the passengers talking about using a drink cart to smash down the cabin door. And an astute member of Scholars wrote to me and said there's a problem here because cockpit voice recorders don't record voices in the passenger compartment. Not only that, but at the very end when the plane is about to go down, you hear these alleged Arab terrorists saying Allah Akbar, meaning God is great is their last words. But in Islam, there's a prayer for every occasion, and if you're facing imminent death, that is not the appropriate prayer, but rather one that says in Arabic, there's but one God, Allah, and Muhammad is his prophet, which means those who were doing the script on this production didn't know enough to get it right.
We also have, this actually, I believe, came from the FBI during this this trial, that the Barbara Olson phone call to her husband. And, of course, we learned about the box cutters for the first time through these alleged Barbara Olson cell phone call from Flight 77.
It's complete rubbish, Richard. Her husband, Ted Olson, who is our former Solicitor General, if you can believe that, he's the guy who represents the administration in arguments before the Supreme Court, gave three different versions of this. none of which have withstood inspection. And, in fact, the FBI has acknowledged that there was no completed call from Barbara Olson to Ted Olson. So this is really complete and utter rubbish.
Now, how, then, do we explain the phone call that the Beamers would have received from their son and others? I mean, how would that have been pulled off?
Well, there are a couple of possibilities. Now, remember, this guy is an expert in the creation and manipulation of public myths. Now, he knows you got to have some incidents that make it human to people. So you might have used voice morphing technology to have one or two of these, but if you actually look into the phone calls, for the most part, they were through intermediaries. Like you have one of these guys talking to an operator, allegedly, for something like 40 or 45 minutes. Now, how much sense does that make? Here he's facing imminent death, and instead of getting a hold of his family, he's talking to an operator for 40 or 45 minutes? Of course, the operator would have no idea about how to identify his voice or whether this is the real person or not. So this is all very clever ruse, Richard, a very clever ruse.
But in the Beamer case, he did talk to a member of his family, his mother,
yeah,
didn't he?
Yeah, but he said that it was funny that he wasn't being responsive. You know, they weren't actually having a conversation. He was saying these things, but it wasn't as though he was actually reacting to what she was saying. So she thought it was an odd phone call, and I say it would be. If, in fact, they'd morphed his voice and were just, you know, playing a pre-recorded message, it wouldn't be responsive.
And do we know for a fact that these alleged phone calls were supposed to have been made on a cell phone rather than the air phone, which would be a satellite phone in the back of
I think Boeing's conceded that 757s didn't even have air phones at that point in time, so. I mean, the further you go in it, the worse it gets, actually. I just flew into LAX, right, LA International Airport here today because I'm in Southern California for my 50th high school reunion. And it brought back to mind that these planes, these flights were all going to LAX. And that when one party only showed up, you know, expecting to meet her partner, her husband, they evacuated the airport. They shut it down. And I think the reason was you would have noticed the reporters would have been there to interview, you know, the survivors of these devastating events, but there were none of them there. I mean, this whole thing appears to be contrived. In fact, some students are making an analysis of how many names of those on the alleged passenger list actually have been included in the Social Security Death Index. And how many of them were beneficiaries or families were beneficiaries of the Survivors Fund. And it turned out of the alleged, say, 19 who were supposed to have made these phone calls, only one of them has a name on the Social Security Death Index, and the number who benefited from the Survivors Fund was less than that, zero.
In other words, what, that the 18 out of the 19 that made these cell phone calls don't exist or never died?
Well, it's very strange. I'll tell you, here's something quite striking. The survivors of the families at the World Trade Center are quite animate about, you know, wanting to know more, wanting to talk about it, very concerned, going through a grieving process. The families of those who are allegedly on the plane don't want to talk about it at all. It's like they want to be secret. It's like they got this money and they don't want to risk the fact that maybe the government made a mistake by giving them this money. There's something very, very strange here, and it's a gross difference, Richard. It's not subtle at all.
And all of those planes relatively empty.
That's right. Each of them only had about 25% capacity, which meant you could have taken all, theoretically, if there were these passengers on these planes, you could have loaded them all aboard any one of those planes. There was a very interesting report about Flight 93 having landed at Cleveland Airport, got taken to a distant part of the airport and being unloaded into a hangar with tremendous security. The claim was there were over 200, which is suggestive of all of the occupants of all four of the planes. The mayor of the city even went out there and was recorded and interviewed by a local TV outlet. Now, that has had a very strange history. It was revised like about 14 times before they finally reputed the whole thing. In other words, the story was so damaging and so disturbing to the official account that they tried to modify it to make it innocuous, but they were unsuccessful, and they just finally just repudiated it.
All right. Jim is in Etobicoke. Welcome to News Talk 1010. You're on the line with James Fetzer, founder of Scholars for 9/11 Truth.
Hi, it's a pleasure to be on your show, Richard, and nice talking to you, James. I just want to make a point that I believe everything, every point you've made makes sense, is logical, and I agree with everything you said. Ultimately, I think that the whole circumstances surrounding 9/11 point to, I guess you'd call it, the hidden hand. And the only thing that I haven't heard mentioned tonight that I think that needs to be mentioned is the connection to the ultimate source, the Illuminati. What are your feelings and views on this? And I'm wondering, how do you think that this ties in, if any?
Well, I got to tell you, I mean, this is an Alex Jones area of expertise as opposed to a Jim Fetzer area of expertise. I am willing to you know, go so far as to name those who I think were principals here, which include Dick Cheney, Donald Rumsfeld, Donald Fife, Paul Wolfowitz, Richard Pearl, General Richard Myers, Rudy Giuliani, Larry Silverstein, with collusion from Israelis, probably experts from the Mossad, who are brilliant at performing, you know, demolitions. They may have had a role in destroying the Twin Towers. It turns out that Larry Silverstein and Benjamin Netanyahu, for example, the extreme right-wing Israeli politician, are very close personal friends. About 2 weeks after 9/11, Ariel Sharon said that we own the United States and we own America and the Americans know it. There were five persons who were observed on a rooftop across the river watching the destruction of the Twin Towers, taking film and photograph and celebrating and photographing themselves in the foreground with the destruction in the background. This alarmed so much their neighbors that they called the police. When they apprehended them in a van, the arresting officer walked up and the driver told him, we are Israelis. We're not your problem. The Palestinians are your problem. They were incarcerated for 71 days until an assistant to then Attorney General John Ashcroft directed their release. They went back to Israel. Three of them went on television and explained that they were there to document the destruction of the World Trade Center. Obviously, you couldn't be there for that purpose unless you knew in advance it was going to happen. The person who directed their release was none other than Michael Chertoff, who just happens to be a joint U.S.-Israeli citizen. Just as Dov Zakheim, who was the controller of the Pentagon at the time, it lost $2.3 trillion, is also a joint U.S.-Israeli citizen. I elaborate more about this in my piece entitled 9/11 and the Neocon Agenda that you can find on a Google search.
All right. Let's say hello. We actually have to break first, and then we'll get to Mario and others waiting on the line. If you've got a line, hold on to it. James Fetzer is the founder of Scholars for 9/11 Truth, and you're listening to The Richard Serrett Show. Stay with us on News Talk 1010 CFRB. James Fetzer stays with us until the top of the hour. We have Bill Gibbons, the dinosaur hunter. We'll lighten things up a little bit at 12:30. He's tracking big cats in the UK. He'll tell us about that. Now, James Fetzer is the founder of Scholars for 9/11 Truth, and I just want to make one point before we move on, we were talking about the involvement of certain parties in this, and this needs to be said, and it can't be stated strongly enough. What we are talking about here are rogue elements within certain intelligence organizations and rogue elements within certain governmental organizations. We are not talking about citizens of any particular country here.
Yeah.
That needs to be stated categorically.
Oh, you're absolutely right, Richard. That's a nice point to emphasize.
Rogue elements here.
Yeah.
Okay. Now, before
I get very highly positioned and very influential. And for the most part, these are people who signed on to the what's known as the Project for the New American Century that was advocating the increased use of American military power to extend its influence worldwide to create an empire greater than any the world has ever seen, where they talked about going aggressively into the Middle East to not only take control of their oil, but to have a huge base of operation there for projecting American power outward from that geopolitically strategic area. But they said, they lamented that it was unlikely to take place with the support of the American people, unless there was an attack from a foreign power, such as a new Pearl Harbor. So what they really were talking about was something they were actually planning and designing, namely 9/11, which was, you'll even remember George Bush described it as a new Pearl Harbor. He said he went to bed that night and wrote in his diary that the new Pearl Harbor occurred today.
All right, let's check in with Mario, who's in Brampton. Welcome to News Talk 1010.
Hi, gentlemen. Hi, James. Hi, Richard.
Hi.
Yeah.
This information that you're giving, I don't for a second think it's false. My worry is, how are these rogue elements going to be brought to justice for the crimes that they've committed?
Well, that's a great, great question. You know, I believe that there are a lot of members of Congress who are very worried that if they indicated that that was their intention, that they might do something even more drastic, that they might have a second 9/11. In fact, I just published a piece in the last couple of days entitled that the GOP wants another 9/11 to boost John McCain. This is on the assumption that the Palin mystique does not endure, and I believe that we're going to discover so much about her that she's been such a hypocrite that she's lying, she's talking out of both sides of her mouth at the same time. She may be gorgeous physically, but mentally and morally, she's completely corrupt and bereft of integrity. I think that's going to become manifest in the next week or two.
Why, do you know something that we don't? Because, I mean, that's a pretty serious allegation. My take on her is that I think she's is pretty much as she presents herself, but I think she's basically a lamb being thrown to the wolves. I think that she was chosen to get McCain elected, and after that, she'll certainly be no Dick Cheney. She'll be delegated to cutting ribbons.
Well, let me mention just a couple of illustrations of what I'm talking about. She talked about, you know, taking on the oil companies and arranging for a pipeline that was beneficial to Alaskans, but it's all in the planning stage. It hasn't gone anywhere. It hasn't even been approved. She talked about it as though we're already in the works. This is something in the distant future, so that's a complete fabrication on her part. Her husband is an active member of an organization that stands for Alaskan Secession. She gave the keynote address 2 years in a row, and the head of that organization has explained and expressed very vividly, and we have this on tape, that he hates the United States. He thinks the United States is a disgrace. He wouldn't even want to be buried in the United States. I think we have here, you know, the GOP's Reverend Wright problem. And I'm very suspicious, by the way, that this baby appears to me to, in all probability, be the offspring of her Bristol. It just so happens that she didn't look pregnant. When she told reporters she was pregnant, they looked at her in disbelief and said, "You got to be kidding." There was no evidence she actually was pregnant. Her daughter Bristol was out of sight for 4 to 5 months on the claim that she was suffering from mono. I think this whole thing is completely phony, and I expect it's going to blow up in their face.
Well, we'll have to. I mean, I think both tickets have some major problems.
Here's another good one, Richard. There's a story for which there appears to be substance that she had an affair with her husband's business partner, and when this issue arose, he rushed to have his divorce records sealed, but the judge refused to do that. I think you're going to find the National Enquirer and the other tabloids are going to have a field day. And remember, you can't really just dismiss them. They pointed out that John Edwards had had an affair a long time ago before the truth finally
emerged,
and he admitted it himself.
That's true. Well, and Barack Obama's camp has some major problems. There's a federal suit currently that he's not even a natural U.S.-born citizen.
But think about that, Richard. That's got to be rubbish. I mean, for God's sake, the guy's a Harvard Law graduate. He knows the legal requirements for being a candidate for President of the United States. He wouldn't allow something like that to happen.
All he needs to do is answer the allegations and produce a birth certificate.
I've seen a copy of the birth certificate. It certainly looks authentic to me, but I don't believe there's actually going to be an issue here. I know Phil Berg, by the way, who brought that suit, and I just think this is a colossal misjudgment on his part, in my opinion.
All right, we shall see. All right, Jim, stay tuned, or stay put. We'll catch up on the other side here. The Richard Serrett Show, back with more in a moment on News Talk 1010 CFRB. All right, we have news at the top of the hour, fast approaching. We cheated in that last segment. So, James, are you still with us? Is Jim still there?
Yes, I'm here.
Okay, can we steal some more of your time after the top of the hour here?
Yes, you can.
Terrific. Okay, because let's just talk a little bit. We've got about a minute and a half here. Flight 93 that crashed in Shanksville, Pennsylvania in this field.
Allegedly,
yeah. Now, it's interesting when you look at photos of the crash site, very little debris. What can you tell us about what might have happened there?
Well, I mentioned George Nelson, this Air Force crash expert, and you know, knows all about parts, who's observed that none of the thousands of uniquely identifiable safety-related component parts have been produced by the government for any of the four crashes. He said to me, it looked to him at Shanksville as though someone had taken a bulldozer out there, dug a ditch, filled it with trash, and blown it up.
And were there any bodies found?
So far as I know, absolutely not. You know, the claim is that you can't see the plane because it disappeared into an abandoned mine shaft. Well, this is completely absurd. I mean, we know what to do with miners trapped in mine shafts. We bring out all the heavy equipment. We work night and day under floodlights and all that on the hope that by some miracle someone will have survived. We did none of that. In fact, we kept the reporters and photographers 1,000 yards away. When it was all done, it was all tidied up. It was all smoothed over, as though this was a golf player, you know, who'd been caught in a sand trap, and they had to rake it back. And then they cut down all the burnt foliage so it couldn't be subjected to chemical analysis to see what was the actual cause of the burning.
Well, wait a minute. That's a crime scene. That's tampering with a crime scene.
Oh, absolutely. Just like they took JFK's limo and sent it back to Ford Motor Company on Monday after the assassination, had it completely stripped down and rebuilt from the frame up to the tune of $1 million. That was a crime scene on wheel two.
All right. We've got news coming up. James Fetzer will stay with us for a short spell after the news. Back with more of The Richard Serrett Show on News Talk 1010 CFRB. All right, we're going to take this discussion right to the bottom of the hour with James Fetzer, Professor Emeritus at the University of Minnesota Duluth and the founder of Scholars for 9/11 Truth, because we have some more ground to cover here on the 7th anniversary of 9/11. The Pentagon. We haven't talked much about the Pentagon, and the question to my mind that remains unanswered is why there must have been hundreds of security cameras pointed in the vicinity, in the direction of the Pentagon. Why have they not released any of those?
You have only to ask the question to understand the answer. Yeah, I think there were as many as something like 82, and they released a couple of frames, five frames initially, and then eventually under duress from Judicial Watch, they released three videos, but none of them showed any more about a plane than the first frame of the five frames, where if you look above the guard mechanism, because you're looking from a parking structure toward the building, you see a silhouette of what could be a plane, and there's a white plume. Now, if you take the silhouette of a 757, which is a 125-foot wingspan, and impose it over this plane, it's 155 feet long, it's much too big if you scale it to the size of the tail. But if you take this largest carrier-based plane, an A3 Sky Warrior, and take the silhouette and impose it there, it's a pretty good fit. And in fact, there was a photograph taken by someone who was taking care of the Arlington Cemetery, who, with a cell camera. There's a big difference between the A3, which is only 76 feet long, and the 757, because the 757 wings come out almost, not quite perpendicular, but for the A3, they're definitely V-shaped. They're spread back. And you can see from this photograph, even though it's not very poor, it's very poor in resolution, that they're spread back like an A3. Now, several pilots have told me that that white plume can't be from the jet exhaust because that's black, but it could be from a missile. And this appears to support the point I was making before, that actually they substituted the plane. This is the plane that actually came to the Pentagon and fired the missile in to kill these guys who were looking for the $2.3 trillion and had all the records. I can imagine you see Donald Rumsfeld the night before telling the section chief, be sure to have your men and all your documents there, because I was embarrassed having to go to Congress to tell them we were missing $2.3 trillion and I want them to find it. Because if you fire a missile in there and you destroy the guys who are doing it and all the records, it can never be recovered. And there's ample evidence that no 757 hit the building. Pilots for 9/11 Truth, which is one of several societies that emerged after I founded Scholars, obtained the black box that the National Transportation Safety Board alleged to have come from Flight 77, and they studied it, and they discovered that instead of having a very sharp angle approach of the plane toward the Pentagon, that it's actually like perpendicular toward the building, that it's much too high to have taken out any of those lampposts, which appear to have been props, and that just as a second before it would have had impact, it was like 100 feet higher than the Pentagon, which is 77 feet high. So this plane, if it actually, the black box data, if it actually corresponded to the plane, flew over the building. And interestingly, I have a friend from JFK Research who had a buddy who was a truck driver who just happened to be in front of the Pentagon at that time, and he told my friend that he'd seen this big plane head toward the building, and then at the last minute it swerved off, and that was really quite striking. My friend was writing to me to say, now, he didn't see a plane hit the building, but he insisted a plane had hit the building, but not the one he saw, and it happens to fit exactly what the pilots have turned up based on their analysis of the black box data.
Now, you've talked to pilots for 9/11 Truth, and Hani Hanjour, who was at the controls, presumably, according to the official version. We're talking about a craft that's traveling in excess of 500 miles per hour.
Right, which is probably actually aerodynamically impossible. I'll tell you, the official trajectory has the plane just barely skimming above the ground as it hits the Pentagon on the ground floor. On the ground floor, Richard. I mean, the actual hit point's about 10 feet high and about 16 or 17 feet wide. There's unbroken fence, unbroken windows. There's some cars there, some cable spools. What you don't find is a massive pile of debris from a 100-ton airliner made out of aluminum. You don't find the wings. You don't find the bodies, the seats, the luggage. You don't even find the tail. In fact, would you believe they never even recovered the engines, which are practically indestructible? But the key point is this. There's something called ground effect. that keeps a plane when it's the faster it's traveling, it builds up a pocket of compressed gas, which is actually air beneath the fuselage that keeps it from getting very close to the ground. So that even a little Cessna at full flight couldn't get closer than 15 feet to the ground. With a plane like that, if it were traveling very fast, it couldn't get closer to the ground than 60 feet. Not only that, but if it had been traveling so low, it would have been plowing up the ground. I mean, the lawn would have been a complete and total mess. And yet the lawn, in the aftermath of the alleged hit, is perfectly smooth and green as a putting surface. You expect Tiger Woods to show up and start practicing his putting.
And we had CNN reporter Jamie McIntyre on the scene saying initially in his report, no sign of an airplane here.
That's exactly right. It's just like the two reporters who were in Shanksville. They both said the most stunning feature of the scene is that there's no evidence that any plane crashed here.
All right, let's grab a call from Fred in Whitby. Welcome to News Talk 1010, Fred.
How you doing? I just wanted to say the older stock of aircraft like the Sky Warrior, a lot of that stock was converted to drone aircraft. That means it could be radio controlled from the ground.
Yes, yes. We have reports from two workers at a small airport outside of Fort Collins, Colorado, who said that there were two A3 Sky Warriors there. This is prior to 9/11. They are being retrofitted. They were being equipped with missiles and with remote control guidance system, and it was all being done in a compartmentalized fashion so that those who were working on the plane in one part of it didn't know about the others who were working on the planes on other parts of it. They said it was very odd that they would be doing all this work and investing all these resources into planes if they were merely going to be used for target practice.
Thanks for the call, Fred. I guess then the question is, James, what happened to Flight 77 and the passengers, Barbara Olson et al.?
Well, this may all just be, you know, phantom passengers. Remember I said there's a stunning difference between the survivors of those who died at the World Trade Center and those who were allegedly on the planes. They don't want to talk about it. They're reluctant to address it. They refuse phone calls if you were to call them. I got a guy who was doing research on all this, and he was just stunned by the fact, get this, you're not going to believe this. He found many cases where he could identify a passenger's name with an address and a phone number of somebody who's still alive. In fact, his most striking result, and I actually wanted to keep this under wraps and make a big deal of it when I wrote an article about this, he found that there was Osama bin Laden on the Warner Brothers lot. And just think about the genius of that. You can explain this guy there because he's just a character acting for a movie you're making about Afghanistan and 9/11. But as soon as he announced it, all that information, all that data about Osama just disappeared.
Wait a second. You mean there was an Osama bin Laden whose name appeared on the passenger manifest?
No, no, no. This is a guy who is tracking names on the passenger manifest, but also Osama bin Laden, to see if he could locate them as being alive and well and living in the United States.
I see.
And he found a surprising number who were, and he even did an Osama bin Laden search and found him located on the Warner Brothers studio lot.
Okay. So, again, just to repeat, because this is important, much like the fact that there are apparently about half a dozen of the 19 alleged hijackers still alive,
yeah.
You're saying that research has been done and they have found a number. We don't know the number, but a number of these the passengers who supposedly died on Flight 77 or 93 or...
Who seem to be still alive.
Hmm.
That's exactly right. I've been meaning to write this up. Now, I write, you know, a lot of press releases. I mean, I write all of them for the Society, but I just haven't got to this one yet because I wanted to find just the right way to present it. But I think it's extremely important. I'm just telling you, look, it's like the fact that there was this engine found, faking evidence here in this case is just littered with it. There was an engine found at church in Murray Street that supposedly came from one of the 767s, but the engine appears to be from a 737. Not only that, but Jack White, who's a legendary photo analyst in relation to JFK and has been doing all this work on 9/11, has found Fox footage where you can actually see a van at that location and guys in FBI jackets were unloading something heavy. And it appears to be that they were unloading the engine to set it down on the sidewalk. It's fascinating that this engine is sitting on the sidewalk, which shows no damage at all. Can you imagine a heavy object like an engine coming at high speed, hurtling down onto a sidewalk and not shattering the concrete, and yet the concrete is not shattered here? Here's another case you're going to love. An attorney from Columbus, Ohio, has done research on this big piece of fuselage that it was photographed from several different locations as though the government thought it would double the amount of evidence indicating that the 757 had actually hit the building. He traced it back to a crash in Calais, Colombia in 1995. and showed how you can even see in the piece of debris, there's a part of the vine that ripped it off of the plane when it crashed in Calais. I'm telling you how bad it is. Here's something else they're not going to believe, Richard. If you look carefully, the two lime green fire trucks, civilian fire trucks, showed up immediately and put out all the fires at the Pentagon in like the first 15 minutes. And yet later, much later, you had these massive billowing black clouds coming up from the Pentagon that could even be seen from the Capitol. Well, if you study the footage, you can actually see those billowing black clouds aren't even coming from the building. They're coming from a series of enormous dumpsters in front of the building. This was a special effect. I even had a guy come through the Duluth when I was living up there a couple of years ago who had 44 more frames that showed exactly the same thing. In fact, they were taken from a different point of view, and you could see daylight between the dumpsters and the building.
Well, it just gets, the official story, it does, it gets more improbable all the time.
Richard, it's complete rubbish. It's a house of cards. But you see, it's like when the JFK, they just give it out their position and then they stand pat, see, and they let all the argument go on between the Popular Mechanics guys. I've had people out there don't even know that Popular Mechanics was subject to a hostile takeover, so they could have put these people in place of the old experienced editors and managers of the magazine so they could write this phony hit piece, and then you get the credibility of Popular Mechanics for complete rubbish about 9/11.
All right, listen, we're out of time, but a quick question, and then we've got to go, and that is, are you at all confident that we will see any of the real culprits, say, indicted within the next 10 years?
Devoutly to be wished, Richard. I think it's going to require, an international experts to review this case. It can't be done politically in the United States. The Republicans would never allow it to happen. When JFK was reinvestigated in 1977-78, it was a charade. I think it has to be very high level. I do believe that the culpability of these individuals can be established, and I do hope that within the next decade, something like you described takes place.
All right. James Fetzer, thank you so much for your time tonight. And again, the website, 911scholars.org.
My great pleasure, Richard.
All right, James Fetzer. All right, when we come back, after the news at the bottom of the hour, we'll check in with Bill Gibbons, the dinosaur hunter, lighting things up here on a Thursday night, Friday morning. The Richard Serrett Show, News Talk 1010 CFRB. All right. We are approaching news at the bottom of the hour with John Elston. On the other side, we'll speak with Bill Gibbons, the dinosaur hunter. Let's work in one more call. James Fetzer has left the building, but I'll see if I can handle this one solo. Ian in North York, good morning. Welcome to News Talk 1010.
Hi there. Thank you for taking my call. I don't usually phone in for anything about these 9/11 conspiracy theories, but when I was listening to your program, there's one thing that is really just missing. They were talking earlier about the passengers and the passengers who have died, but there's no explanation of where they've gone like that. I don't understand how, and probably in some of the biggest airports like Newark and Dulles and at Boston, how these places that are filled with security cameras probably did capture Barbara Olson on video there. They probably caught her on video going through customs, going through everywhere, getting onto the airplane, and there's probably even video of the airplane taking off. And then all of a sudden, there's a gigantic explosion inside the Pentagon. These people are gone, and there's an airplane missing. I mean, call me crazy, but it sounds like an airplane crashed into the Pentagon.
Well, as to the missing passengers, we do have United Airlines reporting that Flight 93 landed in Cleveland. That was an early report. Were those passengers ordered off the plane? Flight 77 into the Pentagon, it's interesting that while we're told that no large parts of the airplane, were in existence because they melted under the heat of the the fire, yet we're told that the coroner was able to identify certain passengers through their dental records. That's kind of curious, don't you think? The dental work would not be melted, but the engine of the airplane, etc., would be. We have the situation at the debris field in Shanksville, Pennsylvania. No bodies found. And the county coroner, a gentleman by the name of Wallace Miller, keeping in mind it's a state statute that state and county coroners and pathologists have jurisdiction over autopsy reports, the county coroner, rather, filed not one report. Not one. And he supposedly was doing months of work at the crash site. No photos. Nothing but some documentation on DNA testing. So, where are the passengers? I don't know. But as James Fetzer pointed out, some follow-up research has concluded that some of those individuals reportedly dead, those airline passengers, are still alive. I don't know about that. We'll have to check into that. But too many questions remain, Ian. Too many questions. All right. We'll be back on the other side. Bill Gibbons standing by, the dinosaur hunter, when the Richard Serrett Show continues on News Talk 1010 CFRB.